Chiefs over the Packers 33-21, and the Bears beaten by the Bills 28-27. Both teams rested their starters in advance of regular season play. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Well, today will be fine, mostly sunny skies, a high of 79. Normal for this time of year is 77. Dry conditions this evening. Then some showers and storms will move in, mainly after 1 tomorrow morning, a low around 70. Then for tomorrow, some lingering showers and storms, likely mainly during the morning hours. Tomorrow's high 82. Then for tomorrow night, more showers and storms possible, a low of 69. Then Labor Day's forecast is identical to Sunday's forecast, a 40% chance of some additional showers and storms, with the high both days in the low 80s. Right now we've got sunshine, a temperature reading of 60. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. I'm David Cole, WGTD News.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is no small feat to write a published novel. I mean, to write a novel that is picked up by a major publisher. And it's even more of an impressive feat when that first novel is as incredibly successful as Margaret Wilkerson Sexton's first novel called A Kind of Freedom. The New York Times called it her luminous and remarkably assured first novel. And I must agree, this is a really exceptionally fine work, which I have so thoroughly enjoyed reading. It is set in the city of New Orleans, which is where Margaret Wilkerson Sexton herself was raised. And the novel follows the life experiences of 3 generations of the same family. And through the course of many decades, we are following kind of the course of history in this southern city and the plight of blacks there, and how, in some respects, many of the difficulties remain the same, even as life changes and in halting ways, sometimes for the better, but always looming right around the corner is the possibility of some new trouble or disappointment. It's a emotionally rich novel and meticulously crafted with a beautiful eye for detail. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it, as have many reviewers across the country. And it is an award-winning novel, which is just now available in paperback from Counterpoint. Again, it is titled A Kind of Freedom, and Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, and thank you for that welcoming introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, I really have enjoyed this book very, very much. The novel takes its title from something called All Aunt Hagar's Children by Edward P. Jones, and you have this quote right at the front. They were the children of once upon a time slaves, born into a kind of freedom, but they had traveled down through the wombs with what all their kind had been born with, the knowledge that God had promised next week to everyone but themselves. Explain a little further what you think is behind those words, and especially those four words that comprise the title of your novel, A Kind of Freedom.
Yeah, sure. So I had just left my job as a lawyer, and I was traveling, and I was reading that short story collection, and I came upon that quotation. And I thought, that's exactly what, I hadn't even started writing this book yet. I was working on something else. But I think behind most of the work, or much of the work that I create, is this urge to demonstrate the degree to which we are fettered by our past. And a lot of times that's just in a logistical way, because of systemic oppression, and it's very tangible and concrete, and you can look at certain systems and laws that have led to present day restrictions. But in some ways it's psychological too, and it's just the haunting of being raised by people who were raised by sharecroppers, and those people were raised by former slaves, and it's just how that how the shadow of that legacy would just follow you and haunt you. And so I tried to instill both that psychological and that very real, those very real constraints into the book. And and that's what that passage represents for me, the degree to which we're still fettered by virtue of to whom we were born.
Right. So in other words, even for a people who, at least on the surface and in every sort of official way, are now free of a bondage mm-hmm. that was once in place, there is a different kind of bondage, maybe more subtle, maybe invisible to the eye, that is still present, at least in the hearts of many, and it can
exert
a kind of control.
Exactly, and it's a kind of bondage, it's a kind of control, and so we are only experiencing a kind of freedom. You know, it's not complete or absolute in that way yet, and so yes, I thought it was perfect for this book. The funny thing is, the book that I wrote before this that was never published had the same title, and I never thought it worked for that book. I was trying to use it for that book because I so love that title and I wanted it to fit, but no one ever thought it quite worked for that book. And then that book never got published, and I started working on this one. And the original title for this book was Early in the Morning.
Hmm.
Yeah, but nobody could remember it. My editors, they would be like, you know that book, you know, Really Late at Night, or, you know, or, you know, Half Past Dawn. It was always some kind of reconfiguration of the title. And finally I was like, well, no, it wasn't me. Finally they were like, we need to change the title. No one can remember this title. So we thought about it for a while, and one of my editors thought that maybe it could be a title in Creole. And that didn't do anything for me. So I just kept thinking, and finally I was like, you know, I actually think that other book's title would fit really well here. And it did.
It certainly does. We're speaking with Margaret Wilkerson Sexton about her first novel called A Kind of Freedom. The framework of the novel is not easy. That is, we are talking about three different generations of the same family, and we alternate between them. And I wonder if you could talk about that framework and how challenging it was for you as the author to work with that framework in a way that does not leave the reader confused? And also, what about that framework do you think was beneficial to the overall effectiveness of your novel? Because we could have read about the earliest generation in part one of the book and then proceeded from there to the second and proceeded from there to the third. What do you think we gain as the reader by alternating back and forth between these three different generations as we do?
Yeah, I think it plays with time to have the storylines be parallel, and I think it plays with the reader's perception of time and perception of history and how far removed it is from the present day. I was on this panel at Squaw Valley Writers Conference, and it was a historical fiction panel, and we were talking about why we use history, and we all had different ideas about it. But what I said was, I use history to show the degree to which things don't really change. And I think setting these storylines up almost as if they're happening in the same moment can really relay that in a way that I wouldn't have been able to relay if it were just three block passages, which I was thinking about doing. I was thinking about just doing, 75 pages of Evelyn, and then 75 pages of Jackie, and then 75 pages of TC. Actually, I was going to do it in reverse order, though. I was going to do TC, then Jackie, then Evelyn. I thought that would be interesting. And that might have been interesting, too, because I think that would have also just altered the reader's sense of time in that way that I'm talking about. I think that might have been interesting, too. But there's something about reading about going in a matter of pages from something in the 40s to something in the 80s, and then, something in post-Katrina New Orleans. I think there's something about that, the proximity of those experiences and the juxtaposition that really makes the reader, or helps the reader to understand that things haven't changed much. And that was my hope, at least.
Right. I think you achieved that very, very well. Let's spell out for our listeners these three generations and the primary characters whom we meet. The novel opens with the earliest of the stories from the late 1940s, or I should say 1944, late in the Second World War, when we meet a nursing student by the name of Evelyn, who is Creole. And her father is a doctor and has achieved a very solid place in the community, and wants that for his daughter or better. And of course, the problem is that she falls in love with someone who does not align with her father's highest hopes. Tell us about the man, Renard, with whom Evelyn is attracted and ultimately falls in love.
Well, he has an enormous amount of integrity. He's had it's the 40s and he lives in the Jim Crow South, and his life is certainly not as privileged as Evelyn's, and most black people's weren't at that time. She's from an exceptional category of experience. But, despite his setbacks, he has these huge ambitions to be a doctor, and he has an enormous amount of integrity, and I think he has a chip on his shoulder, especially with regard to dating someone who's so privileged. But he's willing to try, and really I think he's the rock of that family, and it's only the systemic structures that came in place that that interfered with the legacy I think he might have had.
I really love a moment when, well, first of all, I love the way you craft the account of their courtship, which is very hesitant. It does not take off like a rocket at all. And as we read it, we are left to wonder, is this going to turn into anything? And of course, eventually it does. But I should think you had a lot of fun kind of thinking about what words to give these two characters, how to write this so the way that Renard behaves, his halting hesitancy, feels very, very real, as though this is very much the way a relationship would emerge from two people from two such distinct classes.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. And it was really fun. And it was fun to try to keep it true to the time period as well, you know. And a lot of that hesitance on his part is just what I imagined it would be like, you know, during that time when the standard was just a little bit different for how soon things happen in a relationship. And, and of course she's from such a polished background. So it was fun. It was fun to write that relationship developing, and still trying to keep it, you know, develop the way any relationship would develop, as you had to keep these like proper parameters around it.
I appreciate the moment when you have Evelyn's father, again, who is a successful doctor, who is anxious that her daughter does very, very well for herself and on behalf of the family. And one of the things that he says to her is, you could have any boy in this neighborhood, in this country, I might dare say. You have your whole life ahead of you. Who knows whom you'll meet out there? You're so young. You don't know what it means to have choices. Don't throw your life away over a low imagination. What an interesting choice of terms. I've never seen that before, that concept of low imagination. But one can see how those words would really resonate with someone who's maybe lived a life in which they've had to do a whole lot of settling as opposed to striving for something better.
Yeah, I hear you. And thank you for pointing that out, because I hadn't, you know, you write all these words, you don't necessarily zero in on all of them. And I thought you were going to talk about this other passage that reminds me of, where he says, you know, you think the world is one way because I've made it that way for you. I'm paraphrasing. But the sense that he sheltered her so much that she believes that her choices won't have consequences. And I thought that was interesting, too. It's just really, I mean, it's what any parent would try to do for their child. But the fact that he's able to do it in the 40s, in that environment, and so the reader knows so much more than Evelyn does at that time about what the consequences could be. A lot of that is because we've seen the future through the book, but a lot of it too is because we know the weight of history. And I mean, Evelyn is so sheltered in that way, like that line she has about slavery, how, you know, it was only a vague notion she had of it. It wasn't real to her, and that's the way the war felt. I mean, she's so sheltered, and so it's interesting to see how the father is sort of the voice for what the reader senses and knows about history and about the future.
Well, absolutely. And I also appreciate the fact that it is the relationship between Renard and Evelyn that, in a sense, stokes Renard's own sense of confidence and determination. And this is at a point when the money is not flowing anymore from a friend's mother to pay for Renard's education, and he is trying to spell all this out for Evelyn. He said, they said they would pay for my schooling. Andrew's mama can't pay anymore, and I promised myself I would finish no matter what. He's explaining why he enlisted in the Army. What other option did I have? Work at Todd's for the rest of my life, saying yes, sir, to the manager with my eyes on my shoes, pay officers half my pay just so they'll leave me be? He paused, looked at her, his brown eyes shining. It's no way to live, but I could have survived it if I hadn't met you. I want better for you. I want better for us. The idea that just in having someone else in your life, that in and of itself makes you want to have a better life for the sake of both of you and the life that you want to share together. I had just never stopped to think about the role that something like that could play in someone's life.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for saying that. And yeah, it's interesting. I love how you put it, that it stokes an inner confidence in him that's even something he can dare to attain at some point. I'm proud of him. Of all the characters in the book, I'm really proud of him. I feel that he and Evelyn too, but, you know, he came from such a poor background. I think he did a really great job.
Yeah, no kidding. His nickname at one point is the Uneven Man, because he's a little bit unkempt looking and certainly not handsome, but there is a lot to admire about him and a lot to love, as it turns out. Well, jumping ahead, the second generation involves the daughter of Evelyn and Renard many decades later. Her name is Jackie, and it is the story of the very, very turbulent relationship between her and a man named Terry, who is contending with very serious substance abuse. And there is this sense that there's always the possibility that even when they are trying to rebuild the life they had, that it's all going to crumble away. At one point, she says she felt like every evenness she had regained was being snatched back, that she was doomed to a certain and dark fate. Talk for a moment about the challenge of crafting the story of Jackie and Terry, and of sort of mixing together the right proportions of hope and hopelessness.
That's a really good question. I think the biggest challenge for me in writing that was zeroing in on what I thought the connection between Evelyn's section and TC's section was. I always had Evelyn's section and I always had TC's. I knew that Evelyn would be polished and that her grandson would be in and out of jail. But I didn't understand what happened in the 80s to create a child like TC. And so I went through many, many drafts of Jackie's section, and it wasn't the case for the other two. With the other two sections, they just came out. But I went through many, many different versions of Jackie's section, and I finally, through research, realized I wanted to lay the blame on the war on drugs, basically. I think that's, and the mass incarceration that followed from that, and just the mishandling of the crack cocaine epidemic, treating it in a criminal way as opposed to a health crisis. I realized that was so significantly responsible for a lot of what we see today. And so then I started to have to figure out, well, how am I going to make that a story? You know, I mean, that's the sociological theory, but how are you going to make that a story? And I thought, well, maybe her husband is on drugs. And so that came to me. But then I had to figure out how much of the emphasis I wanted to put on his drug use. You know, it could have been a totally different story. It could have been, you know, she doesn't know he's on drugs, and then she finds out he's on drugs, and then she, you know, and then she has to battle with him over rehab, and they get through that. And, you know, I could have had much more of an emphasis on that aspect of it, but I didn't really want to show that. I just wanted to show more of the shared humanity, and I think a relationship is a great way to do that. I think just especially the high points of that relationship, I thought that would be a nice way to allow the reader to empathize with the characters, despite some obvious differences that most readers would have between themselves and these characters, especially Terry.
Right, absolutely. And, of course, when Terry shows up, Jackie is confronted with some really difficult choices about whether or not to allow him back into her life, and what will her family say, and at what point should she even let them know. And it's so interesting, at one point when she's thinking about whether or not if it makes sense to reveal any of this to her family, you have her thinking that we decided we'd wait to tell my family, that it would just add another layer of pressure, a group of people waiting on you to fail. And of course, mm-hmm. I think most of us, even if we haven't found ourselves in these kind of really difficult circumstances, can think of ways in which family sometimes is that group of people whom we do not want to disappoint. And it's one of the worst feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
You also give to Jackie one of the best lines in the entire novel. this idea of this idea that life could drag disgrace out of you. And I think that's such an interesting way to put it, that the lesson she has learned the hard way, that life could drag disgrace out of you. And our heart just breaks for somebody who finds themselves in that kind of circumstance and not knowing exactly how to escape it.
Thank you. I really like that line too. And it is heartbreaking to think of someone, and you know, she's not even 90, you know, she's in her 30s.
Right.
And to already have that idea that life could drag disgrace out of you, you
right.
know, it's something you would expect to see in the mind of a person who's, you know, facing death and they've had a terrible life, but they're in their 80s or something. You know what I mean? But she's in her 30s and she already thinks that. It's really interesting.
Right, exactly. And it's so sad to think about somebody at a point in life when things should be blooming and flourishing.
Right.
And instead she's
right.
hanging on desperately and so worried about the next thing. I mean, living with a terrible kind of uncertainty. The third and final generation is Jackie and Terry's son, TC. And part of what we'll say about his story is that, in his words, he had been square before the storm, namely Katrina.
Yeah.
But it is in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and in the midst of trying to rebuild some semblance of a life that he gets into trouble himself. Say a word about the special challenge of writing a story positioned after Hurricane Katrina in the aftermath of that devastation.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. And you know, there are so many elements to that. Like, I didn't want it to be a Katrina story. You know, I felt at that time that Desmond Ward had written a great Katrina story, and I just that just wasn't what I was going to do. I wasn't going to talk about the storm, you know, or I wasn't going to talk about people in the face of the storm, I'll put it that way. But I did want to talk about the aftermath in a quiet way, because I think that's how many New Orleans many New Orleanians feel, that the storm is obviously still affecting them, but it's in a quiet way, it's in a subtle way. You know, much of the city is back together. You know, you go in most areas, you wouldn't know it had happened, but many, many people wake up and they can't go a day without thinking about what happened before Katrina and what happened after Katrina. And when people describe things to you, they'll say, oh, that was before Katrina, or they'll say, oh, yeah, that was right after Katrina. It's kind of like the baseline or the framework for the way they think about their lives. And so I wanted to show the psychological impact that storm has had. I don't think that's been addressed enough. And the way it could creep up in someone's life and create havoc, and you wouldn't really know that it was that had caused it, but it was certainly trauma, and certainly had a huge impact, especially on everyone, but especially on the children who experienced it. And TC is one of those children.
Right, absolutely.
And, yeah.
And in many ways, you have him thinking as he's first getting out of jail, thinking back on his life and all of the ways in which he has been a disappointment to himself and others, talking about one more example of his not-quite-ness, of being not quite what he should be or the kind of man that he could be. I also think it's interesting that at one point when he is in the midst of, I think, smoking some marijuana and kind of experiencing mm-hmm. that high, that one of the things he experiences in the wake of that is feeling like his problems are repositioned as opportunities. That one of the things that is so alluring about that is the way in which it makes things that would be or should be seen as very negative and to be avoided suddenly seem like enticing possibilities. That's really sad to think about, isn't it? I mean, because what an enticing trap it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. And then I just loved writing that character so much. I can't even tell you. I missed him when I was done with that section. I just thought, you know, it's true. I mean, his set of circumstances is very sad, and I won't give anything away. But on the other hand, I thought his spirit was just so indomitable and just alluring, and I just really liked spending time with him on the page, because it's just that kind of thing. Like, you know, he smokes and his problems are suddenly opportunities. And I, you know what I think I'm trying to say is that he's a kid, and you see that even, that's what I wanted to show. And that's what I see when I read it. He's a kid, even though he has so many more problems than a kid should. And than most kids do. He's just a kid. And I think that spirit really shines through his character.
Absolutely. Your book reminds me of a recent TED Talk from 2017 by Rutger Bregman, in which he talks about the poor decisions that poor people sometimes make, and the blithe assumption that too many of us make that poor people are poor because they're dumb, and because they're dumb, they're making a lot of dumb decisions that undercut what otherwise might be successful lives, and thus they are, in a sense, to blame for their own poverty. And Rutger Bregman very persuasively makes the case that poor people are making sometimes poor decisions because of the circumstances in which they find themselves. They are not making dumb decisions, he says, because they are dumb, but because they're living in a context in which any one of us would make dumb decisions. And in a sense, that's part of what is going on in your novel, with many of these characters contending with a plethora of challenges and difficulties, sometimes managing to make the right decision, and in many other cases, making decisions that weigh them down and carry them further down. And that's part of what makes this novel so very, very powerful.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if I'm familiar with the TED Talk, but I read an article about that, about how you kind of get into a pattern where you know you're not going to have these big yields of opportunity or big yields of finances or anything like that. So you settle for the little burst you can get, and oftentimes those entail making bad decisions because you're just trying to get a little bit of pleasure. Is that same premise that you're talking about? I read an article about that with why poor people seem to make decisions that drive them further into their poverty. In this book, you know, it's funny because Evelyn's certainly not poor. Jackie's middle class, and she has the agency of using her father's money if she wants, but they're still inhabited by that sense of desperation and limited opportunity, and much of that is really not due to any personal fault of their own. It's just the environment that those characters are living in.
Absolutely, and the idea is that any of us would make some poor decisions were we thrust into those same circumstances.
That's right. That's right.
I love the rich mix of experience that is part of this book, and at turns it is a heartbreaking novel, but also at many turns incredibly inspiring, sometimes hilariously funny. I mean, I said at the top emotionally rich, and I really mean it. Again, it's titled A Kind of Freedom. It is published now in paperback by Counterpoint and the author, Margaret Wilkerson Sexton. Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, congratulations on a marvelous debut novel. We look forward to seeing more of your work in the years to come. And thanks for being part of The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The time is 8:44, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. Here's part two. Any of you who love to receive or write letters, as I do, will so appreciate a marvelous new book which is called To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. And Simon Garfield, a talented and prolific writer with many books to his credit, has done a superb job of taking us through the long history, the surprisingly long history of letter writing and correspondence, and gets us thinking about it in some very, very intriguing ways. And his book is a treasure trove of examples from throughout history over the centuries of important correspondence between famous people and also plenty of correspondence between perfectly ordinary people. But it helps us understand the way in which intimate letters shared between acquaintances, friends, relatives, often bring them vividly to life the way nothing else can. The book is published by Gotham, and I'm so excited to be speaking with Simon Garfield about his book, To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. Simon Garfield, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
You are very careful to say early in the book that this is not a book against email or anti-technology, and yet at the same time, there is, of course, that very strong thread of regret that as we turn increasingly to communication through email, text messaging, and that sort of thing, and turn away from the standard letter slipped into an envelope and mailed at the post office, that we are losing something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use emails as much as anyone, you know, and I text and I tweet and all that sort of stuff. And I embrace all of that because that's, you know, that's a modern way of doing things. And it's very efficient, it's cheap, and it's quick, and it works. But as you say, I think we're also, facing a great sense of loss, really, because we tend not to write, you know, even emails, certainly not texts or tweets, with anything like the same sort of depth or emotion or thought that one does when one sort of just applies oneself to write a letter. And I think that's a great loss. It's a loss not only to, you know, our grandchildren, perhaps, who won't find, you know, who won't find out about as much as maybe we would find out about our grandparents through their letters, because it's going to be very hard to, you know, get through all our passwords on our computers and the cloud and all of that kind of stuff. A great loss to historians, I think, as well. So, you know, wanting to write the history of famous people now or in 50 years' time, how are they going to track their lives, if not through letters? I think that's going to be hard. But I think even beyond that, we are all losing, I think, the ability to write at a greater length, you know, because all of these things are very instant. You know, you write an email and they tend to be quite short and punchy, and then you write another one because you're replying. It's more like a sort of, you know, a phone chat in a way. You know, a lot of people think that emails are a passing phase and it's all going to be doing instant messaging and little short messaging, and that's the way we're going to communicate. And very soon it'll all be, you know, visual as well. It'll all be on Skype or the equivalent of something like Skype. So we're not going to leave a written record behind us. And the idea of the book is, as you say, to kind of celebrate what's gone on and the way we've written in the past and great letter writers, but also to ask the question, are we really prepared to lose, you know, all these great attributes that we get from writing a letter?
I want to ask you very specifically about a line from the chapter that opens the book called The Magic of Letters, in which you say the world once used to run upon their transmission, that is, the transmission of letters from one to another. The world once used to run upon their transmission, the lubricant of human interaction and the free fall of ideas, the silent conduit of the worthy and the incidental, the time we were coming for dinner, the account of our marvelous day, the weightiest joys and sorrows of love. It must have seemed impossible that their worth would ever be taken for granted or swept away. A world without letters would surely be a world without oxygen. I think somebody who is young enough to not engage at all in the writing of letters. I mean, they're just too young to live in a world where that was commonplace, would probably read those words and scarcely believe them. Probably can't imagine that. I mean, the world around them seems to function just fine and doesn't need this mysterious lubricant to which you refer. Of course, I'm old enough to know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm wise enough to completely agree. So what does one say to someone who has not really ever in their young lives experienced the world as you describe it?
Well, it's very hard, really, because you can't, you know, you can't convince someone of you know, a glory of you know, a train that used to run by anything other than kind of oil, or diesel, or electric. It's hard to say how glorious it must have been once to, you know, be on a coach and horses or any of those kind of things, or the early joys of kind of air travel, you know. And it's because everyone thinks, oh, actually, what, you know, every young person thinks what we have now is the best that there's ever been. And in many ways, that's kind of true, I think. You know, you kind of, you know, as you said at the beginning, I've got nothing against these things, because they work and they are absolutely of their day. But I think with something like letter writing, you kind of have to say, okay, you almost have to put, you know, if you're talking about young people, you have to almost put things in front of them and say, okay, well, this is what my grandfather wrote, you know, during the war. And in the book, there's a wonderful sequence, which I was so fortunate to obtain from the two sons of the correspondents in the book. It's a wonderful sequence of letters during the war from a postman who was working for the Signal Corps in North Africa and Greece in 1943 and 1944. And he wrote to someone that he used to know back in London, you know, during the Blitz, and the bombs were dropping, and you get all that wonderful history, and in great detail as well. But what you also get is this wonderful developing love story between them, so they hardly knew each other. So it's that kind of thing. You sort of want to say, okay, now read this and say, this is what it used to be like, this is what we're going to lose. Now show me an equivalent in texting or emails or something like that. But the you know, the sort of scary thing, as I, you know, as I kind of mentioned a little bit, is that whole thing that emails are a passing phase. Is this is what you know, archivists really believe now, that actually young people kind of think that, you know, the formality of an email is even too much, because you've got to sit down and write it in a certain way. You can't use text language. You have to put someone's address in the special field, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But that's becoming too much of an effort, and all we're going to be left with are these little words, you know, little short lines in the ether, with which somehow we're going to have to patch together our history in 100 or 200 or 300 years' time. And you can say, okay, well, will that matter? But I think it does.
You take us back to ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and to correspondence as it has sort of evolved through the years. And another interesting facet of your book is, from time to time, there will be these chapters called How to Write the Perfect Letter, in which you explore some of the different ways in which one can sort of hone one's skills as a communicator in the writing of letters. And there is a wonderful chapter which is called Love in Its Later Forms, which explores this notion of the love letter. And, of course, you take us through some of history's most intriguing love letters and write at one point, "Love letters catch us at a time in our lives when our marrow is jelly, but we toughen up, our souls harden, and we reread them years later with a mixture of disbelief and cringing horror and, worst of all, level judgment." I think that's so interesting that in a sense a letter preserves a moment in our lives when we, in a sense, were someone else. And even when it is we ourselves who wrote the letter, we can sometimes read it and feel like we're reading the words of a stranger. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, if you've experienced that yourself or can think of interesting examples.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly, you know, as you say, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to kind of write those words had I not felt that way myself when I was a teenager in love for the first time. We would, you know, I would write letters, and fortunately, I still got a kind of great shoebox full of letters that my first proper girlfriend wrote to me when I was 16, 17, and they're great things. They're incredibly embarrassing, of course, but they tell you who you were, you know, at that time, as you say, and they're wonderful things to have, partly also because they're handwritten and they're sort of from the heart, you know, the thing with emails is they all look the same, so you can say anything on them, but actually they will look the same as if they came from no matter who. They wouldn't have a kind of personality to them in the presentation, in the way they feel. In the book I sort of, in that chapter that you mentioned, I begin with John Keats, and he is dying, you know, in his 20s. He's in Italy. He goes to Italy because he's been told that the air there is better for this terrible disease he has in his lungs. And he writes the most beautiful letters, not only to his girlfriend Fanny Braun, but also to his friends back in London. And as you would expect from someone like John Keats, they're fantastically poetic letters. I'm lucky enough to live in London, just around the corner from where he used to live when he was in London, in Hampstead. And I went to see some of the letters there. They've obviously got them preserved behind glass cases. But they're lovely, flowery things. And you can also witness the decline in his health from the way he writes as well. It's kind of as clear as that. And then I link it to... he writes to a friend called Charles Brown. So I thought, okay, well, that's an obvious link to Charlie Brown. And then I start talking about how Charlie Brown in the Peanut strip didn't get any love letters. You know, he would have put his hand as deep, deep, deep inside in the postbox as he possibly could, you know, and there would never be anything there for him. And not all the cartoons, but half the cartoons would be about that. You know, would he get any letters from the red-haired girl that he fancied? And then I go, you know, to Charles Schulz, and when he died, these letters came out, which revealed an affair that he was having, you know, a great love affair with another woman. So, you know, it's a whole circle of life that you can link through letters, and a remarkable thing. And the thing to, you know, for instance, I have a letter. From Charles Schulz, where he obviously writes to his friend, and he has cartoons in there as well. You know, so obviously he would do cartoons of Charlie Brown or whoever, and then you look at some of the letters from the great artists. My favorite letter, which I talk about right at the end of the book, which I wanted to buy until I realized how much it was going to cost me, is a fantastic letter from Edward Manet, where he writes just to a friend, but he also draws, and that's what you can't get in an email either.
That's very, very true. And you have further intriguing examples of letters of Virginia Woolf, Jack Kerouac, Emily Dickinson, an amazing five-word letter which she writes at the very end of her life, and touch on other important letters from throughout history, an account of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. All that we know firsthand comes from someone writing a letter about that incredible moment. And that and much, much more. I think we come to the end of your book and realize that, in fact, it would be a very different world without the letters that have been written down through the centuries. The book is called To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing, published by Gotham Books. Simon Garfield, I thank you for writing this superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on the Morning
Show.
Well,
I'm glad too, Greg, and thanks ever so much for having me on.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information available.